Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
I'd like for you to join me in welcoming to Dallas and Fort Worth the senior military leader of the Army, General Pete Schumann. Well, Hicks, thanks very much. And I'm looking at the room here. This feels a little bit like church, but nobody wants to be in the front where everybody can see the collection plate who's doing it. I will, first of all, thanks very much for the invitation to be here. And what I would like to do, because I understand what you really want to do is get into questions and answers, and so I'll try to be fairly brief in my remarks, just to frame a message from the Army so that you have kind of a framework of understanding about what we're trying to do. Let me congratulate the Dallas-Fort Worth World Affairs Council as well for recently being named the most dynamic large council in the nation, and I believe that that recognition took place in February. Now, one of my good friends, Hugh Shelton, when he was the chairman, he used to start out speeches sometimes by a little story that had to do with young elementary school student that was to write an essay, and they got to pick anything they wanted to write about. So this young lady picked she wanted to write an essay on Julius Caesar, and her essay went something like this: Julius Caesar lived a long time ago. Julius Caesar was a great general. Julius Caesar gave long speeches. They killed him. So what I'll try to do is not fall into that trap with you here, because I am very appreciative of the invitation and what we're doing to try to communicate to the American people how important our efforts are, how dangerous this period of time in history is for us, and how we must communicate and have a continuing dialogue over the really important issues that face us today. Now, Linda Robinson and I had a morning together. She's a U.S. News and World Report, and we flew in this morning, did a little thing with National Public Radio, and then Linda and I had a good time together and had a great conversation. And she represents media that, in my view, represents the best in terms of responsibility, in terms of trying to dig into the issues. And I'm not plugging her magazine, but what I am telling you is Linda has been there, has taken the time to spend, Linda, would you say you've been 5 months in Iraq, has teamed up with our soldiers, and really, as I have a conversation with her, I understand, and she understands, that, and this is very, very important to be on that kind of wavelength, because it is so, so important. And we are so frustrated often by the inability for a coherent message to go out through the media, because the engagement of American people is so important. Let me talk for a minute about, give me the next slide, please. Let me start out by talking about the strategic context that we find ourselves in today. And I'll show this, what we call a spectrum of conflict, and I promise not to make this a school lecture or anything, but you know, the spectrum really runs from this bookend of stable peace all the way up through general war. And as you know, we spent most of the Cold War trying to deter the former Soviet Union so that we never had to fight this general war, especially up at the very tippy top end of that thing, which would have been in the deployment of nuclear weapons. And so as you look down, as you kind of pull this thing apart and you take a look at, well, what are the kinds of things that occur across that spectrum? And you think about what the challenges are of this century, you find that we really now are challenged across the most complex piece of the spectrum. This is what America understands about war. World War II, where you're going to have a victory on the battleship Missouri were the nations that you fight, you defeat, and they capitulate. That is not going to happen in this war. And I remember when I was a kid, and I used to hear about the Hundred Years' War and the 30 Years' War, and I wondered, how could they have fought for it? Because, you see, my mindset was my brother Mark is here with his wife. I said, Mark, what's going on here? What are you guys sitting so far apart for? Jane's way up here and Mark's back there. But anyway, our father spent 32 years in the Army. He was in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And our understanding of war as children was always about the kind of wars our fathers fought, where there was clear lines, there were definable enemies, there were national interests that were very clear to understand, and we all understood that it was all about generating enough power to defeat the other guy. That's not the kind of fight we're in today. We're in a war of ideas today that is going to take generations. And some, you know, people keep asking me, what are we going to do in Iraq? Listen, Iraq's just a small piece of a very, very big problem. And the problem we have today is that where in the past, most of the really dangerous tools in the world were owned by nation states. And quite frankly, the construct under which nations operate goes back to 1648, the Peace of Westphalia, at the end of the 30 Years' War. That's for the first time a nation state had monopoly over the use of military force. That's when nation states exercised sovereignty over their borders, where they had central governments, etc. And that has been the status quo construct ever since. Today we're being challenged in that very construct. Since I graduated from high school in 1964, we now have almost twice as many countries on the face of the earth. And most of those new countries cannot control their borders, and they cannot exercise sovereignty over their internals, and there's a real problem. And so we are now being challenged, because this is where conflicts taking place. And oh, by the way, you now have non-nation state actors like Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, that are in search of and may have weapons of such destructive power that only nation states in the past had them. And because they were nation states, and because they had things you could hold at risk, infrastructure, their cities, and these kinds of things, these non-nation state actors do not have anything to hold at risk, and therefore our whole concept of deterrence is at risk. You do not deter these actors. And we know what they're trying to do. And so this notion about having options, about backing out of this, is one that I personally think is a huge mistake, and one we must communicate to America how serious this is. We did a conference, and I spoke to Linda about this morning. We did a conference at the Military Academy where we brought in a group of people, a third of which were for-profit CEOs, a third were non-profit CEOs, and the other third were general officers out of the Army. And we met in a group much smaller than this. I think there were about 20 from each of those components. And we talked about the world, and it's called Investment in America Forum. And one of the things one of the speakers brought up, that is a very well published speaker, and unfortunately I can't remember his name, but I bet Kay remembers. But he okay. I can't even repeat it, but you all heard it, we'll be glad to get you. But listen, he said this: 6 billion people in the world today. 6 billion. 5 billion of them are living on less than $2 a day. Okay? 5 billion of them are living on less than $2 a day. The United States of America is about 5% of the world's population. We're consuming about a quarter of the consumables, and we have our hands on over half the wealth in the world. Now, what does somebody living in a cardboard box on less than $2 a day have in common with buying into a status quo power arrangement, honest quote? They're not in the mall like we are. You know, there was a little thing the other day about, you know, the armed forces at war, but America's in the mall. They're not in the mall. They're scraping every day. And I'm telling you that the answer to conflict is not in our ability to dominate the top end of the spectrum. It's in our ability to engage in the world and to start working on the things that are necessary to work on to help turn in this globalized world. And take away the advantage and the traction of the ideas that are out there. So I've spoken to this probably longer than I should it, but what you need to understand is, for an Army to be relevant, it has to be relevant in the center of the spectrum, not the way it used to be. Same with an Air Force, same with the Navy, same with everybody. This is not the same world. When the Soviet Union went away, the world changed forever. And the bipolar tension that existed no longer exists. And so we are now dealing with things that are infinitely more dangerous to this country. And the kinds of issues that you see us deal with every day now, even internal, domestic issues, immigration and all the rest of it, are all tied to the risk in which we find ourselves. Next slide, please. On the Quadrennial Defense Review, which many of you know by the acronym QDR, Quadrennial Defense Review, which is a congressionally legislated study that has to go on with the change of every administration and every 4 years, came up and we went through a whole strategic kind of turnaround, and we thought now, and we said, look, the kinds of things that we're going to face in the future, going back to that spectrum I showed you, are the traditional, which we're most comfortable with, forms of warfare. The irregular, which we're seeing a lot of, the catastrophic, which has to do with the catastrophic impulses or attacks to the United States, and we're talking about really catastrophic, not things that are down here that are just disruptive. We're talking about things that have the kind of effects on the economy or the kind of effects on populations like Katrina might have had, which happened to be a natural event, but it's not hard to imagine being able to create that level of problem to others. So this is, these are the four quadrants which we're working, and here is where our way has been, right down here dead center in the traditional. And the fact is that we've got to continue to have a deterrent effect on those other status quo powers that are out there, so we can't give up in the traditional realm, but we have to shift our weight into areas here that allow us to be more agile in terms of what the strategic environment is. And that's what we're doing as a Department of Defense, and the Army is part of the Joint Forces doing the very same thing. And so what Hicks talked about in terms of some of the transformation of the Army into a more modular force, into a force that's more useful in a joint context, and one that's much more strategically agile, and one that has the kind of capabilities to operate not just up on the high end with the lethal piece, but in the non-lethal areas and in the other kinds of things that are necessary, as we operate. And then, of course, what we have to remember is that this isn't just a military problem. That when we talk about the elements of national power, we use this acronym DIME, D-I-M-E, and we talk about the diplomatic, the informational, the military, and the economic. And those are the elements of national power that have to be shifted. And even in World War II, these elements came together. And one of the challenges we have today is that traditionally the M in DIME, the military component, tends to dominate during conflict. And in today's conflicts, that military element may not, in fact, dominate. In fact, the diplomatic, informational, or economic may be much more important elements of national power in the equation as we deal with these other kinds of components here. And that's where we find ourselves most trapped. And you've probably heard about the news. You've heard a lot of discussion about the interagency and about the inability to project to the battlefield like Iraq or Afghanistan things out of the diplomatic aspect of our interagency, the State Department, USAID, commerce, justice, and all those. You know the challenge we have informationally, because we are now in a flat world where the media and the speed at which information moves is extraordinary. And the funny thing about it is the most extreme story, the biggest lie, or the biggest twist of the truth, has all the Velcro on it. It sticks to everything that it touches. The truth will zing around as though it was Teflon coated. Nobody's interested in that. It's not exciting. What they want to hear is about all those, those thorny issues with great impact. And I'm not just talking about the media here. I'm talking about populations that are disadvantaged in positions that I talked about in this world, because that's what they need a reason why they're where they are, and they need a culprit. And they need all of this, and so this stuff feeds in such a way that's very, very problematic. So it's a war of ideas, and the kinds of things, it's tolerance versus prejudice, it's freedom versus subjugation, it's compassion versus hatred. And I'll remind you at this stage here, because I had this conversation a little bit earlier, do you remember how long it took us to write our own Constitution? It took 13 years. We had Articles of Confederation for about 6 or 7 years. The Congress was called back together to fix the Articles of Confederation. They couldn't, so they broke the rules and they wrote a constitution. And what were the things they couldn't solve? Slavery, taxation, states' rights. What happened 80 years, 1789 was our constitution. What happened 80 years later? We fought a civil war. Over which issue? Slavery, taxation, states' rights. When was the legislation then enacted? When was the civil rights legislation enacted? 100 years after the Civil War. 100 years. 1964, Civil Rights Act. And I gave a speech out in Virginia, 1 hour west of Washington, D.C. this year, or actually 2006, on Memorial Day. And I didn't know it when they asked me to come out there and speak, but I found out after I was out there, that was the first integrated Memorial Day service they'd ever had in that county. 42 years after the Civil Rights Act. They had a black service in the black cemetery and a white service in the white cemetery, and this is for Memorial Day. So sometimes we need to look ourselves in the mirror and understand that, you know, these ideas and these big notions that we're in such a hurry to get everybody to wrap their arms around in these strange cultures, in fact, were very difficult for us to wrap our arms around. And we have got to understand, first of all, nobody's got the patience to wait 200 years to get this stuff to occur. But it is, gives you an idea about how long it does take for some ideas to get traction, and quite frankly, how successful in many ways we've been in getting some of these big ideas through some of these very difficult things. So, I'm elaborating upon what's so different about how we find ourselves today in terms of things. Give me the next slide, please. Let me just show you very quickly, I'm not going to dwell on this, but this Army today is employed at over 300% of where it's ever been employed historically, in terms of the what I would call stress on this force. And this is an all-volunteer force. This is the highest quality force I've ever been involved with, and it is involved, and of course this picture doesn't even show it all. But we are only 40% the size of the Cold War Army, active guard and reserve. 40% of what the Cold War Army was. And yet we're operating at 300% or more over what we were formerly operating. Go ahead. Next slide, please. I throw this up because this is what it's all about, the United States Army. You know, Craig Abrams said, the Army, the people are not in the Army. The Army is people. We never talk about, you know, the airplane bombed this or you know, something else did there. We talk about people because people are the Army, and it's all about this fella right here, or the gal. And you know, this happens to be a paratrooper from the 173rd that just jumped in the night before up in northern Iraq, landed in the mud, and now is carrying his 200 pounds of lightweight gear on his back. Okay? And the deal here is, and what I remind folks all the time, especially our leaders, our job is not to put more lightweight gear in the soldier's rucksack. And I'm not just talking in a physical sense, I'm talking in a personal sense, by putting pressure on his family, by putting, you know, by failing to support something at home. Our job is to take this weight off the soldier's back, because that soldier and that soldier's family is what is at the center of the Army. And it requires not only soldiers, but it requires soldiers of other nations that also have to play a part if we're going to be successful in the world that we're in. Here's the next slide. So I want to show you, this is no test on this, but I've been a little less than 4 years chief staff of the Army, and I have personal relationships with all the people on this slide. In fact, many of them have changed over 2 or 3 times. I just had a Chinese, General Gu, spelled G-E, was just with me 2 weeks ago. I just met, by the way, down in San Antonio. I was down there at MAMC at Brook Army Medical Center visiting wounded soldiers down there and checking on things. And one of the first people I met there was my counterpart in El Salvador. And this young man, back in my days in Special Forces, I spent a lot of time involved in the bad times down in El Salvador in the 80s. And, of course, we brought democracy and freedom to that country, and they're now one of the biggest and percentage-wise contributors to global war terror. And they had a young Salvadorian soldier down there missing a leg, rehabilitating down there. And guess what? My counterpart, who just took over, was a captain back in the days, and we formed his unit and made his unit successful in the fight. And now he is the chief of their army, and we have a long-standing relationship. And that's true across all of us. And this is so important if we are going to be successful. America cannot do this by itself. We cannot. This is going to take a lot of help, and we're going to have to make sure that what we're doing is sharing ideas and working in ways that are, because every one of these countries each country here has its own interests. And where many of our interests coincide, some of them don't. And what we have to do is make sure that what we're doing is working to the greatest synergistic effect that we can. Next slide. Talk about funding very quickly. I like this because I've used it ever since I've been the chief talking to the Congress. Listen, we are funding our armed forces today at the lowest level we've ever funded them in period of conflict. And you can look over here, and I'll get my little pointer out again. This is World War II. This is what percent of GDP. We were spending 38% of GDP on World War II. Now, I told a little story one time. In 2005, between Thanksgiving and the end of the year, over the Christmas holiday period, the United States of America, according to the National Retail Association, I'm quoting their figures, spent $439.5 billion on the holidays in the United States. That was the equivalent of the base defense budget that year. We would have to spend at that rate for 10 consecutive periods, 6 week periods, to match what we spent as a percent of GDP of World War II. Just to put it in perspective, we have a $13 trillion economy. This is not an issue of affordability. It's not an issue of affordability. It's an issue of priorities. Korea, 14%. Vietnam, Reagan built up Cold War drawdown. That's over what we're spending today. We were below 3% before. And with the supplemental, we are still below 4%. And so one of the big issues, one of the problems I have, is what George Marshall had when he was in World War II. He said during World War II, he said, you know, before the war, I had all the time in the world and no money. And in the middle of World War II, he said, now I got all kinds of money and no time. It takes years to overcome the kind of deficit that we experienced in the decades and 90s. The United States Army was the primary bill payer for the peace dividend in the 90s. We had $100 billion in underinvestment during that decade. We started this war with $56 billion worth of shortage of equipment in the United States Army and our formation. So while we're expanding the size of the Army, we're still having to fill in the holes for the smaller Army that we had. And I still deal with people in the Pentagon today that are so stuck in the bureaucracy. I mean, it's like running in hip boots in a swamp. And it's these bureaucrats in the Pentagon and everywhere else that don't get that. They are so constrained with dealing in yesterday in terms of percentages of the pie and all this kind of stuff. They're totally out of whack. It is so frustrating. And quite frankly, all the leaders, and I'm not just talking about military leaders, I'm talking about many of our civilian leaders who are frustrated with this. And of course, dealing with the Congress. And the Congress is being very supportive, they've come way around, but you know, it still takes 2 years to put a budget together. And this year is the first year since I've been Chief of Staff of the Army that we received the money we asked for, and we received it on time. Last year, 2006, I received a base budget, many billions of dollars short of request, and we received it after Christmas. That was one quarter after the fiscal year started, which meant we had to cash flow ourselves for that first quarter last fiscal year. And we received our supplemental funding at the same time, so it was a quarter late. And the other piece of our supplemental funding didn't come until the 30th of June, which was only 90 days before the fiscal year was over. This is disgraceful. But it is the system and the sludge that's in the system. Last year I refused to turn in the budget and got in all kind of trouble. But nevertheless, we got our budget and we got the help that we needed. And by the way, this year is the first time then that we got money, I think, is anywhere near sufficient and on time. And we're going to have to continue to do that. And the people of the United States, if we want security, are going to have to invest in this, because we cannot keep investing after we're in trouble. And this is like the stock market. I'm preaching to people who probably know a lot about that. But I'll tell you what I do, because I can't afford to do otherwise. I dollar cost average. And I save my pennies, and I grow my little bitty wealth a little bit at a time. But there are some smart people out there kind of time the market. And quite frankly, from what I understand about that is you rarely are very successful doing that because you're generally buying behind the top. I mean, you know, after it's already, and that's exactly what we've been doing. And you cannot build the kind of capacity that we need going about life that way. So here is what we've been saying, and here's finally, this year, a testimony of what I heard back, and that is we need 5% of GDP, and we need it consistently. Some people may not like that, but I'll tell you, if we want to survive as a nation to get ahead of this problem, we better invest in the kind of things that we need, but we're not going to do it. Next slide, please. And I'm just going to finish up here pretty quick. This is not a new problem. Very quickly, let me wrap up. 21st century security environment. It's uncertain, it's unpredictable, it's full of misinformation and misperceptions. I've talked about the traditional, regular, catastrophic, and disruptive challenges that we have. Our vision is to make sure that our Army is relevant and ready and is the most best land power that any place on Earth in service of our nation. Our mission is to make sure that we are providing to the combat commanders, people like General Abizade, the Central Command, General Craddock over European Command, Admiral Fallon out in the Pacific Command, B.B. Bell over in Korea, the kind of forces they need to support the national strategy and defense strategy. So we have four overarching interrelated strategies in the Army plan. The first is, and what I'll do is I'll walk, give me the next slide. First of these is to provide the ready and relevant land power. This means we've got to grow the Army. The President's now made the decision that we're going to grow. We're not only going to grow the end strength by about 74,000, but we're going to raise the number of active Guard Reserve Brigade combat teams to 76, which is a significant growth for Brigade combat teams, and we're going to grow to about 225 other functional and non-functional brigades so we can support on a continuing basis the level of operation. This is a growth of over 30% of our Army in a very lean fashion because we're not growing in the traditional sense the number of soldiers. The units, as has been described in the introduction, are modular units that are fully interchangeable. Because we built modular units, we just swapped out the 4th Infantry Division in Iraq. The 1st Cavalry Division came in and replaced the 4th Infantry Division. They're both modular divisions with modular brigades. Because we could just move soldiers and swap equipment. Equipment stayed at Fort Hood. 4th Infantry Division came back and fell in on it. 1st Cav went over and fell in on the equipment in Iraq. That saved us 7 months in terms of reset. In other words, the transportation of this equipment back and forth and all the rest of it. And it gave us a cost avoidance of over $1 billion in transportation costs and reset. That's huge. We have, and that's the kind of thing that kind of strategic agility is what allows us to do the kind of things that we can do. You remember to cross the beaches in Normandy, which was about 150,000 soldiers across the beach of Normandy over the entire period of the invasion of continental Europe. It took us over 2 years to assemble that force in England and elsewhere. We moved over 600,000 soldiers this year in a period of less than 7 months in and out of Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere else. I mean, it is incredible. The difference in scale, scope, precision, agility, and all the rest of it that we do. And of course, the capabilities that are inside these formations now are incredible. A brigade combat team today has about 3 times the amount of bandwidth that an entire division used to have. Now, a brigade combat team is a 3,500 soldier unit, and a division is a 17,000 traditional person unit. And the most advanced division we had 4 years ago was the 4th Infantry Division down in Fort Hood, and it had about 4 megs of bandwidth in the entire division. Today, we are putting 10 to 12 megs of bandwidth in every brigade, which means that precision and intelligence and sensors and all this kind of stuff can be operated there. So the capabilities are enormous. And the precision that's evident here allows us to be very discriminate in terms of our force, in terms of the application of firepower. Next. Second piece of this thing is train and equip our soldiers to serve as warriors and grow adaptive leaders. We call them, kind of coined this term, cataly. It's because we can't afford to have a bunch of specialists out there that if you don't need that, field goal kicker that he sits on the bench, The field goal kickers, you ought to be able to block and tackle, throw and catch and do all the other stuff everybody else has got to be able to do. And so all soldiers now have to be trained to the 40 warrior task and 11 drills, and all of our leaders have to be able to operate across that entire spectrum. And this is a huge new challenge for our training base, and it's a huge investment now in the education. We're increasing our advanced civil schooling and our officer corps by 200 additional master's degree programs a year. We will have, for our lieutenants coming out, over 1,100 master's degree programs by 2009 that we're putting in. And these are for language, cultural awareness, and the kinds of things we need to operate in the international community. Huge investment in things. Warrior tasks and battle drills, I've talked about, these are live fire. These are not bang-bang and blanks and all that stuff. We are issuing soldiers today their weapons of basic training in the first 72 hours, and they never leave their weapon. Just by eliminating, turning weapons into the arms room and drawing them back out, we picked up 2.5 days of training that otherwise would have been wasted just the administrative drill of turning in weapons and drawing them. And we don't, we expect our soldiers to exercise responsibility over their weapons, and we are deaf on them about the responsibilities there. And they are doing things that that even in the special operations community that I grew up in, you know, they're doing things today as privates with less than 30 days in the Army than we were doing as special forces, you know, over 20 years ago. I mean, it is, they've got the equipment, they're getting the training, so it's a totally different deal. And of course, we're fielding equipment now in ways that they're extraordinary. Next. Sustainment of the all-volunteer force. We say we recruit soldiers. We had the best active recruiting last year that we had in the active force in 9 years. We had the best National Guard recruiting in 13 years. We recruited over 175,500 soldiers in the United States Army last year. That's the size of the entire United States Marine Corps. That is more than all other services recruit put together. And this is out of a young population of 17 to 24-year-old males in this country. Less than 3 of them can qualify to enter the armed forces. Less than 3 out of 10 young men in our country today can qualify to enter the armed forces between the ages of 17 and 24. 23% of them are obese, have early onset of diabetes, have more drug problems and things that are a huge problem. 2% of that population is in prison. About 41% of them cannot pass the AFAP, the basic skills test that we give in terms of math, reading, and, you know, the general technical aptitude. About 4% are either served or disserved. That leaves less than 3 out of 10. Half of them are in college. And so we're competing right now. Actually, in 2006, we got 49%. 49% of our recruits came out of 15% of that population. So we recruit soldiers, but guess what we retain? We retain families. And if a family won't sign up, so they won't stay. Quality of life, very important to us. Next. Infrastructure to support that quality of life. BRAC, I can talk about later. Restationing, military construction. You know, the Congress did not pass any legislation this year except for 2 pieces of the defense budget. The rest of the government's not funded. They're on a continuing resolution. And BRAC and MILCON were unfunded in the Department of Defense. We've been up there banging on the table up there on the hill. That they didn't want to do it. They wanted to wait until 2008 so that we're going to run the government again without a budget. And so we're making some success here because without it, we cannot grow the Army. We won't have the barracks, we won't have the housing, we won't have the motor pools, we won't have the training ranges, and the things that we need to grow the Army. Now, let me wrap it up by saying, pleasure to be here. I know I've probably talked a little bit longer than I should have, but I wanted to frame this thing. I understand we'll have some opportunity to ask some questions, and I'll be glad to do that, and then perhaps we can talk later on some of it. So I hope that's useful to you. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. I know we'll have some good questions. We have a microphone right there in the middle of the room. If I could ask any of our people would like to ask a question. Linda, you might even start us off. Here we go. And as always, if I could ask that your questions be concise, and then we'll move forward.
Sir. I'll give us your perspective on what we hear about our troops are worn out and used again and again and again. And in addition to that, because we're growing the Army.
Well, the last part of your question, I'd say the chance of a draft being imposed is about zero. I think that even though there's some emotional attachment to some people to the draft, both positive and negative, quite frankly, as a professional soldier, having served in the draft force, the nation can't afford to do that, nor do I believe it would be supported by the population, which is a very important component of it. Remember that with a draft force, you're drafting soldiers for 2 years, and we can't do the kinds of things as well with soldiers that have been in the Army only 2 years as we're doing now with professional soldiers instead. And by the way, we're not going to pay them any different. They're going to have to live in the same kind of barracks and all the rest of it. So what you're doing is you're paying premium money for very short-term, very high turnover force that is not prepared to do the kind of things we want to do. So I don't see the draft as an option. Testify to that, and you know, I think we're beyond that. First part of your question is I'm very concerned about the stress on the force because now basically we've got the entire Army that's 1 year in the fight and 1 year out of the fight. And that, in my view, I've got question whether we can sustain that level of operation. I don't believe we can forever. And that's why we're growing the Army. That's why we're, you know, again, though, the decision to grow the Army, it will take us years to grow. And thank God President Bush supported my request when I first came on board to grow the Army a temporary 30,000. And now we're going to be able to keep them because we got the machinery running. We got the 30,000. We got that down payment on our 74,000. And we're going to now be able to retain them. That money's going to be in our budget. And we've already got the machines going on that. But we must complete this plan to expand the Army and modularize it so that we increase the depth of the Army to be able to get increased what we call dwell, and that's time between deployments. So we are very stressed, and I am concerned about it. And, of course, this was a big part of our discussion when we talked about the many options that we had to include the surge option for Iraq.
Mr. Chrysler.
Sir.
General, thank you for your remarks and thanks for your service. Very current issue in Iraq now, this so-called surge. The anti-war people brush it off and say, we fight all of that. And the administration, at least I haven't heard it, hasn't explained very clearly what's different from a military standpoint of what's being tried currently in Baghdad versus previous efforts. Can you explain that in ways that this crowd can understand?
Well, I'll try to. First of all, what's different about now and then is we have a lot more Iraqi forces available to us than you know, that have been trained, organized, and equipped to do it. Secondly, we have a different situation in parts of the country outside of Baghdad. For instance, Al-Anwar province, which has been a horrible problem in the past, is starting to swing in a positive direction. I was just out there again for my fourth Christmas, talking out in Ramadi with people, and 12 of the 16 sheikhs out there are now turning their young men over to be policemen and to form allegiance to the central government, and they've decided Al-Qaeda is not good for them, so they're pushing Al-Qaeda out there. So that's one thing. The Iraqi army is now taking over these external districts, and when I was there at Christmas time, they just took over their third province so that the Iraqi army is actually running it. The other thing that's different is Baghdad, as you know, is broken up into very, very complex neighborhoods. And in the past, we swept Baghdad, but there hasn't been the Iraqi forces and the Iraqi police forces to stay there and ensure that what we swept out of there doesn't come back. What's happening this time is that as the Iraqi forces are leading through there, we're ensuring their success and their stay. And as long as they can stay there and guarantee that security that's been achieved and then bring in the economic, the informational, the sewer, the water, and power, and all those kinds of things, so that the economy can generate, we'll have a chance. But again, it's not going to happen over the weekend, but it is significantly different this effort. I worry about the impatience, because I think that General Petraeus is going to require, as good as he is, he's going to require a lot of patience, but I do believe there's a significant difference in the way this has been approached. Of course, I'm not in charge of that. You know, all I do is just provide the wherewithal to be able to execute the thing. So, you know, I'm very interested because I'm always wondering about, what the hell are they going to ask for next on the deal.
General, thanks again for your service and your leadership. With the necessary expansion of ground forces and transformation put in place, and expansion of the Army's mission into its initially expeditionary missions, do you foresee an increase in the synergy that's been built between the Army and the Marine Corps, or do you foresee a return to perhaps the sufficient conditions?
I think, and I think that's a great question, because I see a lot of synergy across the whole joint force. A lot of it's got to do with the fact now that Goldwater Nichols and the whole joint construct is becoming very matured. But But I also believe that we're now in an era where we cannot have, these specialists and these divisions between the silos. And so the Marine Corps and the Army right now are operating very closely. As you know, we have Navy EW experts and EOD and engineers that are actually embedded in our formations. We have Air Force airmen driving trucks and doing security police work and working with detainees. And so we have a very close thing. Now, I grew up in special operations, and we've been joint for a very, very long time. And those of us that have, I've been a joint officer for over 25 years. And so most of us that have experienced this understand the power in this synergy. It's really only kind of the parade ground guys that kind of get into this dadgum, all this other stuff. People like air shows and fleet weeks and, big parades. They kind of get off on it. I think it ends at the Army Navy game, quite frankly. I mean, that's a great place to have it, but that's where it needs to end, because we need a strong Air Force, we need a strong Navy, and we must have strong soft Marines and Army forces, because that's where the demand is in the century. And we can't be spending time here fighting each other over the pot. What we've got to do is do that. And quite frankly, I've seen this improve so much in my years that I'm very hopeful that we're going to be able to continue that synergy.
Well, John, thank you for your service. And a quick question. Human fleet will land on the air, therefore, Army, Marine Corps, out really how we play out in any of the conflict abroad. With Europe, the declining population and aging, and two senior leaders from Europe in town in the last couple of weeks being pretty much complacent about that, even more than that. And we need to put feet on the ground not only allies, but also our friends and allies. Shouldn't we press our politicians to build broader alliances beyond aging Europe, NATO kind of thing, so that your folks, your guys, your boots on the ground can have allies to support them in broader numbers and more diversity?
Well, absolutely. And I think if you were to put that slide back up again that showed all my counterparts, you'll notice that there are a lot of the old traditional European allies. But guess who's delivering at the best rate? It's not the Germanys and the Frances and the Italys. It's Latvia and Lithuania and the former Soviet satellite, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria. They're delivering because they know. The problem we have in Europe is believe me, we talk about this all the time, and the soldiers and sailors, airmen, and Marines over there, they talk the same way, but the politics of the situation is they're declining in what they're investing in their armed forces and their capabilities. It's a real problem. Second thing is they've got populations. There's a reason why a lot of wars have started in Europe, and they don't assimilate very well. And you can go to France and you'll find out that the Muslim population is not assimilating. You go to Germany, those of you who have been there, you understand the German deal and the Dutch deal and everything else. These are not populations that assimilate and do the kinds of things that have made America great. And so they're breeding grounds for these problems. And now with the EU and no borders and the ability to move almost effortlessly and move money effortlessly and all the kinds of things that have taken place there across all of this, it's a real challenge for us. And so we are working very hard to build new NATO. I'll tell you, ISAF, which is a NATO, the International Security Force in Afghanistan, it's going to determine the future of NATO. It will determine the future of NATO. And if that ISAF is not successful there, NATO is in deep trouble. And I think we all agree with that.
So we've seen in this particular war outsourcing of military functions more than we have in any recent times, both to private companies and also reliance on Guard and Reserve troops more than certainly many Guard and Reserve expected that they would be called up again and again for extended periods. What's your assessment of how effective that's been and whether we ought to keep going that direction in the future or go back to somewhat the other way?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I don't consider Guard and Reserve to be outsourcing. The Guard and Reserve, we have $46 billion worth of equipment going to the Guard and Reserve in this budget between now and 2013. These armories are not places just to have picnics, so we don't issue these uniforms just to go deer hunting them. This is not about that. We're moving the Guard and Reserve from a strategic reserve of the Cold War into an operational reserve of today, and we expect to use them, and we expect them to meet the standard. And we're setting our Army Force Generation Model up to use it. 55% of the United States Army are in the Guard and Reserve. So we cannot deal in the future and have people sitting around armories and worrying about waiting on a forest fire or hurricane to come. It's too much of the Army, too much equipment invested, and too much institutional investment to do that. So I don't consider that outsourcing. I consider it time to answer the call. And that's what they're doing, and I'm very proud of the way that they served. And I will never speak disparagingly about them because I understand the challenges of being a soldier that has a civilian employment as well as... and by the way, I understand kind of the dimension of being recalled to active duty, okay? That's kind of what I went through. I had to get rid of a business, and I had to, you know, pay the taxes and all the kinds of things that resulted in that, and inconvenience my family and all the rest of it. And I did it proudly, and so do they. Now, outsourcing to me is where we're contracting services, and we're doing a lot of that. But what we're contracting are things that we don't need soldiers to do. We don't need soldiers flipping hamburgers in the mess hall. We don't need soldiers peeling potatoes anymore. We need soldiers on patrol and collecting intelligence and flying airplanes and that kind of stuff because we're paying premium there. And oh, by the way, for every contractor that we're paying a pretty good price for, it would have taken three soldiers to do that. What we're paying for is the service. And we don't care whether they hire 30 people. We're only going to pay them, you know, that thing for the service. But if we were replacing them soldier for soldier, it would take us three soldiers to do what most of these things do in terms of our support structure, if that makes any sense. So I think we're going to continue to outsource certain things. I think we're going to continue to outsource certain transportation things, certain logistics things, pumping fuel, doing the kinds of things that we could do in secure deals, and then use soldiers in areas that are less permissive than where we need soldiers that can fight and do their job that way. And quite frankly, as I talked to you about the demographics, I think we have to do it that way. So I hope that answers your question.
These will be our last two questions.
General, I have a question about threat assessment. America is going to continue asking our military to fight the global war on terror. It seems interminable. General Schisler's office now comes out with 75 years data, multi-generational. And our leaders are going to ask American citizens, like all of us, to support this effort ongoing. Now, America is all over the board in terms of trying to assess just what is the threat now from there's guys in caves on the Afghan-Pakistani border, and they have no power really to speak of. We should go back to a police action. To others of us who think, well, it's a foregone conclusion that, you know, they're going to wed states and terrorists and have weapons of mass destruction. How do you assess this ongoing threat to America and not serious?
Well, I think it's very serious. And you know, you're sitting, there are so many places. Just think about the things that are going to happen in the world. I mean, it will happen. Mubarak, one day, is not going to be the leader of Egypt. Who's going to be the leader of Egypt? And how are they going to come in on it? The royal family may or may not remain in the position they're in Saudi Arabia. Musharraf, who is sitting on top of a nuclear-equipped Islamic country, that has got all kinds of factions going on the side of that, is a bullet away. They tried it five times and nothing successful on that. And you know the people that designed the weapon for them were sharing it around the world, the design and all the rest of that stuff. This is not it. This is a matter of when that we're going to see. These people are very serious. You know, the 19 people that flew the airplanes into the buildings, the Pentagon, the World Trade Center, and all the rest of it, they all died with money in their pocket. They all died wearing designer clothes. They all had a good education. They all came from good families. And they all were in this country long enough to change their minds. This is a real deal that we've got to get our arms around, and we must prepare ourselves as a nation to do it, and we cannot think in legacy terms. So personally, I think we're in the most dangerous times we've been in. The size of these toys are too great, and the ability for people, if they ever get their hands on this stuff, it's just too serious. How many people crossed our borders illegally this year? And I'm not talking about farm labor and stuff. I'm talking about what happened inside of all that, inside drug smuggling, inside of illegal immigrants, and it's because the very same techniques, the very same procedures, and all the rest of it are employed to do that. So it is very serious in my view. And I'm not a person that kind of gets overly excited about stuff, you know. But we need to take this seriously. We need to have this debate, and we must have the support to do the kind of things, because we cannot just go to the mall and ignore this.
Sir, my son is back from Iraq with the 506 infantry, and my friend still active duty, telling me the important component both in Afghanistan and Iraq is the civil affairs unit. Yet they traditionally have been kind of relegated to the reserve component. I just wonder, are we going to gear up to have more effectiveness in that area? It seems to be a key to, you know, get the neighborhood back, get the population.
Part of the growth of the Army is a 14,000 person growth in Special Operations Forces, which is a significant increase. We're growing five more battalions of Special Forces, which is almost two groups of the Special Forces. We're growing another battalion of Rangers. We're growing another battalion of Special Operations Aviation, and we're doubling the number of civil affairs companies in the force. And we're tripling the number that are on active duty, and we are doubling the number of psychological operations units that are very, very important in the force within that level. So I think that, and as a former commander of U.S. Special Operations Command, and being responsible for all that, and obviously you're familiar with it, you know that that's a significant investment in very, very talented people. By the way, I don't know if we're going to wrap up or not, but I want to make a point here. You know, my brother's in the audience, and his wife and their son, my nephew, is in uniform. I have a daughter that's a platoon leader in the 82nd Airborne Division. She's a military police lieutenant that is leading a full platoon of men in the 1st Brigade Combat Team of the 82nd Airborne Division. She's married to a young lieutenant, infantry, that commands a platoon, leads a platoon in the 82nd Airborne Division. They're on their way to Iraq. When we look at our General Officer Corps of the United States Army, over 140 of our kids are in uniform. I'm talking about the generals. This is personal. I was just down at Fort Bliss and talked to Sergeant Major's Academy down there, over 800 senior non-commissioned officers. I asked them, how many of you have children in uniform? And 90% of them raised their hand. This is not an abstract deal here. This is real, because it's our own kids we're talking about here. It's very, very serious. And I ask Congress all the time, but first of all, we're starting to see more members of the military now being elected to Congress. I think that's a very good deal. But when I ask them, how many of you have kids? You know, we get lectured a lot about stuff. But how many of your kids are doing this? And that's a really important question. And I'm not lecturing you now, and I'm not asking you to raise your hand, but I mean, I want you to know that this is not an impersonal deal.
General, can you take one more question?
Sure.
From Noble Soldier? Thank you. Like the kid up there, I served in the 173rd Airborne Brigade in Vietnam.
Did gravity still work under parachute the same back then, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. I fall a little fast. And I was also in special operations back in the day with Hank Anderson and all that group. You mentioned that the terrorists that came in and pulled off 9/11 were here. Had money in the pocket, well educated. And I'd like to see if we could get a candid comment. Can you say tonight whether or not the United States can stop somebody with using 35 weapons for a range from coming across our border, building a bomb, and getting a private aircraft and destroying what they want to destroy?
Well, I would, obviously, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but what I can tell you is what's happened. And I know we've been very successful on interdicting, stopping, preventing both way over there as well as here some of these things. But you know we have to be perfect every time, and they only have to be lucky once.
You remember the Georgian incident 3 weeks ago?
The what?
From Georgia, mm-hmm. Former USSR, CIA thing, and you 235 So that's why I asked.
Well, I mean, you can ask almost anything. I think that very clearly There are people that want to do that. They've said they will do it if they can, and they will use it if they can get it here. And so, again, I go back to tell you, I think this is like, you know, you don't have to be unlucky once on that, or ineffective one time.
Sir, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you could stay here.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I could ask you just to remain seated for a moment. We have a special presentation for the General, as Wayne, as you come up. And tonight we have a number of our directors in the room. First, I'd like to ask Pat Patterson to stand, because without Pat's leadership, we would not have won that award. And then if I could ask the other directors to stand. And before I turn the podium over to Wayne, I want to thank the NDA for being one of our co-sponsors tonight. And thanks to the Hyatt, before you all drive home, although I know many of you are staying for dinner, the Hyatt has very generously provided cake and coffee in celebration of the award. Again, thank you for being with us tonight, and thank you, Wayne.
Thanks, Jim, for that introduction. And on behalf of the National Defense Industrial Association, General, we just want to thank you for taking the time to come to North Texas. Thank you for the dedication and service to our country. And certainly we're privileged to have you here tonight. And we've got a little memento we're going to leave with you. If I can dig through the electronics here, bear with me. After talking to some of your colleagues, we decided that this book on Texas cowboys would be appropriate to share with you. And we wish you the very best, sir. And again, thank you for visiting us here in North Texas.
That's great. Thank you very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.